Hey everyone, welcome to Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort. And without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast hails from Kent, Washington, and got started on the saxophone around 10. And boy, when I say that was just the beginning, it was just the beginning. This Berklee School of Music cat plays about any instrument that can make a sound and is truly, if you talk to anyone in the Seattle scene, one of the finest collaborators around. Not only is he cooking up tracks constantly, he's an actual chef of nearly 12 years, so he might as well have exclusive right to that phrase. Working out of his studio, Catalyst Labs, he's worked with the likes of Hentai, Kung Fu Grip, Macintosh, Karma Knows, and former podcast guest Nobi. Those two are actually fresh off the release of their new track, Entity, on all major platforms. Be sure to check it out. The video is also incredible. If that wasn't impressive enough, he also began working at House of Breaking Glass with Philip Peterson, where they are truly on the forefront of innovation for the future of music amid these challenging times. So please welcome the producer behind the up-and-coming Seattle hip-hop superstars, Jake Hilliard, a.k.a. Jake of the Digital.
What an intro. Sheesh.
Yeah,
some wrestling music. Yeah, for sure.
Again, appreciate you doing this, and I guess we can jump right on in. Do you mind highlighting what music looked like for you growing up and how it played into your life early on?
Well, my mother was a musician, and she always kept me involved with music. Like, I grew up playing stupid recorder. But, you know, like, it'd be cool. I was lucky. I got some teachers that were really excited about music and really thought. And they kind of saw something a little bit in me. So even in sixth grade, I remember going to an after-school program where we did everything from like, we'd make like didgeridoos. And nice. we'd make instruments. This guy had an instrument. I remembered back a couple of years ago. I was like, oh, wow. I think he had an MPC. And we all recorded an album and just got into different music sounds. This was like in sixth grade. So definitely like I was super lucky. I had experiences like that growing up. Totally. And we moved to the small town up north and I was already playing saxophone and really just, I remember I was pretty competitive and I wasn't like good at sports, but that was like the one thing that I could be like competitive at and just like kind of try to run it up. And then we moved up north and I just basically didn't know anybody. So I was practicing a lot, and started taking more and more seriously and getting more of a passion for it.
Dude, those teachers are so important, man. Like instilling just that passion for it. Like, oh, this is fun.
Oh, 100%. I think that's like a very underappreciated and undervalued role in the development of most talent. Even just making someone aware of the fact that they can sing or not, or getting them, you know, I'm like, I wonder how much more of a difference it would have made if I even knew about electronic music when I was younger, you know?
Yeah. So did that, is that fun? You mentioned when you moved up north, not knowing anybody, was it still like fun for you though, to like sit in and practice? Had that been kind of instilled or was it more of, you know, just having something to focus on?
I think I always was really serious about music and just trying to be good at saxophone. My mom was like, she was a pretty good musician. So I just had this sense instilled in me to be good at my instrument, you know, and it was a chance for me to be great at something, and I found myself expressing myself through it, and that's when I really took to playing saxophone, is through like jazz band programs and just realizing like the ability to create lines in your head and improvise is like, you know, that kind of talent is like or that kind of skill is something that is very worth developing. And those kind of steps were my big steps growing up and listening to like John Coltrane and all that, of course.
What was kind of your influences then?
I was really into Something Else by Cannonball Adderley, which is dubbed as the other kind of blue. Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, Wynton Kelly, Sam Jones. I mean, it's pretty much almost identical cast to Kind of Blue. It's also Miles Davis's last sideman gig.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Played the hell out of that horn on that record.
Yeah. Oh. So were you like really a student of that then? Like aside from just like practicing and listening, were you really like a student of the game?
Yeah, there was no hip hop. I mean, I listened to and loved hip hop. But I was a jazz musician through and through in high school, even before that a little bit. Like, as soon as I got into stage band, I started listening to jazz, like, a lot more. But it'd be like Stan Getz. Is weird. It's like offshoot artists. It wasn't like mainstream bebop. One of my first records was Stan Getz and Charlie Bird's Jazz Samba. And I just love that record. Still to this day. It's just such a timeless record. It's so simple. But and it's a three-piece band. Three? I think, right?
I couldn't tell you, to be honest.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. That's how much of a jazz purist I know, like, this the personnel. And, yeah, so there's that side. But I had all these rock friends. They were, like, turning me on to, like, Pink Floyd and Dead Kennedys.
Yeah.
We were listening to, like, Infected Mushroom.
Oh, dude, I remember them. Yeah.
So I'd be like jazz on one side, and then I'm playing like weird out there spacey rock stuff on saxophone, smoking bunches of pot, you know, pretty much like a rock star.
Totally. How did like that really like eclectic background and just like mashup of styles when you decided to start like making your own music, you know, how do you think that impacted you?
I think that's a really beautiful part about music is it utilizes the subconscious passive train of thought.
Yeah.
Where you don't really know it in the moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, until you look back at a collection of work that you make.
Right.
And you start to notice certain patterns. Like some patterns I notice is like, yeah, like definitely Ready to Die and Life After Death were insanely influential albums to me. And it's weird. It's even artists that I didn't listen to, like Timbaland, his influence in my music, and Pharrell. Like, you just don't realize that. But having that mixed with this super fusion-y out there, like, one of my favorite rock stories is Pink Floyd. They were the first guys to really get synths on their record with Dark Side of the Moon. And they got these instruction manuals that were, like, the size of dictionaries. They just threw them away.
Oh no, they were just like, we'll get there, we'll
whatever, got drunk and learned how to do it. And dang. I love that stuff. So it's really prevalent now because I look back on that sound and I'm like, oh yeah, I love that feel, that dark Abbey Road sound going through those old Fairchilds. And wow.
Yeah. When did you transition to like also producing, like in like creating those sounds? Because clearly you had a real appreciation for those soundscapes, but when did it really click, like, oh, I can do this, like I can start crafting my own sort of sound?
I think it's weird because I accepted a sound and I learned about creating a sound because of saxophone. I grew up playing alto, and like I play tenor now, but I always told everybody I played alto like a tenor player. But oh, the reason I said that is because I even chose a metal mouthpiece because I picked a sound that was darker. I did not want people to confuse me with a guy trying to play like Charlie Parker. So I understood a lot about sound. So when I picked up production, it was always about trying to create that sound in my head. I still feel like I'm not there yet, you know? And that's like, I don't think it's a place you arrive. I just think you understand more about synthesis, which I can tell you, like, one of the bigger jumps was like getting my Moog and just sitting on that thing because it's so simple. And it just, you can only play one note. You only have two oscillators. You got pad points, which are crazy and create a whole different palette. But how wide of a sonic palette can you create off of that? And that's when I was like, okay, we can really do this. And you know, that coupled with a lot of the production I did on Nobi's album, that was probably the big breakthrough.
Yeah, want to walk me through that project?
Yeah, so Nobi and I met through Shehan, and we started working together, and we worked together for about 6 months, and we're trying to find our way through the sound. And then we had a session with his brother Top, and it really kind of started clicking a little bit. We worked on this one song that we released in February last year. It's actually the first song we recorded together, is Welcome. So that's the first song that we recorded together that we were like, okay, we're doing something now. And I was like ecstatic, because I was in the city for about a year and a half. And I was like, I'm just not meeting anybody that I really connect with. And I met Nobi through live music. And man, from the first time I heard him spit, I was like, this kid
ridiculous.
He has that live energy that is very rare. And I was coming here from Boston, so that's what really speaks to me, is you can be great studio cat. I can sometimes tell if you got that, but like, it's all about that. How do you spit it in person? Do you have that raw? You know, and I really feel like that's one thing I never, like, I saw right away with him. So we hit Welcome, and then I think it's in the same session, I was working on this song with Shehan, and he goes, oh, I got a verse to this. And I go, all right. And I pressed record, and he gives me this verse. My jaw dropped. I was just like, you got to be kidding me. I couldn't believe it. I remember like going to sleep that night being like, just like, how did he do that? Right. It's just like, he wrote this verse and it was perfect for my song.
Yeah.
Like, I'd written the entire song except for this one section, and his verse was like perfect length. It was like 20 bars too. Wasn't even 16. It's a weird, like, it's weird. It's just weird how it lined up. And I was like, this is so, so bizarre to me. So we worked together for the next 2-3 years. And it was really interesting, because I made the beats in a super short period of time. I just had this phase where I was like clicking, and everything I was touching was like just right on it. And Nobi was really feeling it. And we would just sit in my studio, and is a little home studio in Lower Queen Anne, across the street from the Opera Hall now.
Oh, right on. So,
yeah, in a little basement. And we'd just sit there, and I'd like chef food. He'd just write. I'd just play the beat. And it's just crazy. It was a crazy time. Geez. Like, we were just really like finding who we were creatively. Mm-hmm. And one thing I really love about Nobi, his ideology is so cool. And it's so refreshing to work with an artist that has a truly progressive and like firm grip on reality. Because some people have this rose-colored picture of what society looks like.
Yeah.
Some people have like a rose-colored picture of what it means to be an artist and what the responsibility of an artist. And I think it's not for everybody, of course, but for the ones that really want to make the difference they talk about, there's a responsibility you have to speak truth to power and to use your story to empower others and to make others think or have a dialogue. And that's one thing Nobi and I really connected on from the jump, is we'd have these huge conversations about like Che Guevara or Malcolm X, Black Panther movement, Fred Hampton, and like what it means to us today. Like, what does it mean to want change and true change today? How do we find that? How do we as artists make a difference? Because like, a lot of people have the mentality, and rightfully so, that it's like, what's the point? What's the point in fighting or using your craft? Pepsi don't want that. Coca-Cola don't want that.
Yeah, that's facts.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just gonna say, what was that journey like? Obviously, you had the understanding of what your philosophy around artistry was. Was there conversations of, okay, all the songs got to kind of fall into this lane, or was that just what was kind of flowing?
I think that's the best part. And even to this day, it's not something that it's like we look at each other and we're like, yeah, fist in the air.
Totally.
It's not like that. It's more like you can't fake it.
Yeah.
Our only job was to tell a story. That's what we wanted. I said, I don't want somebody, personally, I don't want somebody to present a project that isn't 100% them, no matter what.
I dig that.
That's why I love working with artists of all kinds, all types of artists. Some artists are more cause-driven than others. But every one of the artists that I really love working with believes in their craft, has an idea, and has that intent.
Totally.
The thing that makes an artist special is sometimes that intent is special. And that's the kind of person they'll be is as an artist, I think, most definitely. And that, so the path was like, is very much like, we didn't need to talk about that, the end result.
Right.
We were just having conversations, and this material was coming out from us thinking this way, kind of embodying these, like, or thinking about these ideologies. It wasn't like, okay, now we're going to make a song about that. Like, we'd have a conversation, and then 6 weeks later, something from this conversation would come into a track or something like that. Maybe.
Right.
But yeah, so it definitely, and you got to credit Nobi, no doubt. Cause he's kind of like the silent guy who he has something drawn out in his head. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'll be following along and I'll be like, all right, where are we going with this? Then we'll see how it all connects the dots. And I'm like, all right.
That was one thing that blew me away with the one time I got to see you guys work was insane, because where the song started just sonically in like there was like a 45 minute period where you were just chopping up like a guitar lick. And it just morphed. And then Nobi's out in like the open area at Rainier Ave. And he's like shouting like these hooks. And then you two came together at like the same time. He clearly could like hear what was going on from your studio. Walks in. He's like, all right, I got it. And you're like, all right, cool. Give me a sec. Like 3-4 minutes of you tidying something up. He puts on the headphones, starts just going. And you guys are like, yep, cool. We're moving. Yep. So you mentioned that you guys were like together in the Queen Anne. How long was it before you transitioned to Catalyst Labs then? And how important was that space to you guys really continuing that like evolution of like artistic relationship?
We recorded his whole album at the Queen Anne spot.
Oh, no way.
Mm-hmm. I mixed it all at Catalyst.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's just this, I went through a huge transitional phase, you know, in November 2018. No, it's more like August 2018. So I had to basically find a studio space to work out of. And I was a chef at the time, and one of my cooks was like, hey, I know this guy. And he kept telling me about this guy for like, you know, months before. Uh-huh. And then out of nowhere, you know, I was kind of looking for a studio space to work out of. And out of nowhere, he's like, hey, it's time. I want you to meet this guy. And it turned out it's Tony Benton, who owns Rainier Ave Radio. Uh-huh. And like, so, you know, it was the first time that I ever got the opportunity to have my own studio space. And in the city, it was the first time I worked out of a studio consistently, period. Otherwise, it was all out of my home studio before that.
Yeah.
When I was in the East Coast, I worked out of, you know, a couple of studios. It was fine. Yeah. Like, I came up interning. That's how I learned how to mix. So Catalyst was, like, it was so instrumental because it really made it easy for me to not get into the album show hole. Where you finish an album and you're like, ugh, God, what do I do next? Like, what now? That's weird. Cause I was like, I had this huge space all of a sudden, and I was like, this is amazing. This is a crazy opportunity. So yeah. And for the first 4 or 5 months almost, it was mainly exclusively for Nobi, Karma, and me, and Top, Yell, and people that I was already kind of working with to some capacity. Like, we just would sit in this space, you know, and I'd cook during the day and work as a chef during the day, and then go straight to the studio and be there till like 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. I mean, there are sessions where I was falling asleep, hitting the record button.
Oh, man.
You know, like, but I made more leaps and bounds in 6 months out of that space than I did in 6 years before that. Easily. And that's before the connections, before starting to meet the scene and having a public facing space that I could get involved and like start to really like try to make it make a difference in the scene and like try to use my talents to help artists in the scene, because that's definitely like that's like a super cool role to have in the city.
You're going through this like album process and whatnot. And what did that look like when you opened things up? Was it like refreshing to?
Oh man, there's definitely a period where I got my butt kicked on organizing sessions, because you're used to working with like maybe three or four artists.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have like, you don't have all this like mental space that's like clogged up where you're like, alt, four track.
Yeah.
I think this is the verse two lead take.
Right.
But I don't know. You know, and it, like things like that. And it took me, it actually, I remember sitting in with a couple sessions with another producer, Creeps, actually, and watching his workflow. And I was like, oh, damn. So it does like, so that's how it has to be. Like, you know, because when you're working with 50 artists a year or 60 artists in a year, like every session, you don't want to guess. You don't want to guess what's going on there.
Yeah.
You want to open it up and be like, oh, great. This is 4 hours of unpaid work. Oh, wonderful. Geez. You know, like, yeah. So there's those growing pains for sure. And then on top of that, like learning the balance is definitely like important. You know, you get, you have these projects and studio starts being a job. And then on top of that, you got your projects that you're working on as a producer that like with people like Nobi and Karma Knows and working on the releases. And that's something I really think over the last year, we really got our hands on probably through Catalyst, just having the space to create content and to really start to look at the like the more visual aspect as well. But
your entity was crazy because that was done, or I know that the release performance was, or release of the video or debut, whatever you want to call it, was House of Breaking Glass, right?
So actually that was at LZ Atkins' place, and she is a florist.
Okay.
For Moon Bloom Floral. And she's pretty rad. She's got this cool eye. And she already kind of approached me and was like, hey, I'm looking to work with artists.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, great. Nobi and I have a bunch of songs. And we're kind of already thinking about doing a floral concept.
Oh, no way.
We had this cool image of flowers wilting. LZ hit me up and just kind of lined up really well. And James absolutely knocked it out of the park. So we actually did it in her basement. Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm.
I would never have guessed that.
And the time lapse flowers she shot in her basement, she just did a time lapse, and we did a lot of After Effects and overlays, basically.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
Against a black screen, it was really cool.
That's dope.
That aesthetic. Yeah. When I was mixing it, I knew exactly what I wanted it to feel like. Right. You know, I was like, evil Donkey Kong or something like that.
Dude, that's perfect. I shot Nobi a message when that came out, and it's like a minute 40 something is that switch up, and I was like, that switch up was crazy.
Yeah, well, and that became that's part of the thing that was the breakthrough, and the reason why it's so special to me that my first real full project is with Nobi. Because he's one of the few artists that's so dynamic that we kind of have this thing now where it's like, we want to keep the listener guessing.
Yeah.
We'll flip a beat 3 times in 4 minutes, 3 minutes even, if we can get away with it.
Yeah.
And we'll, as writers, one of the things I personally get into as a writer is if I have 2 sections in a beat, I can juxtapose those sections. And I have literally like a little mini concept album, because you can take those two ideas and juxtapose against each other. And all of a sudden it's like a work. You can take them separate or you can take them together, and together they make the song. And that's the concept.
I like that. I'd never heard it put that. That's a super cool perspective.
That's kind of how I always looked at it. Yeah.
Yeah. The stuff like that is always awesome to me. And I love that that came through, because one of the things that I love is on the Lone Wolf and Cub stuff they did, was some of those switch ups that they did between, not, it's not Vintage, it's the one with Carmenose. And when they did this switch up where there's like the, I don't even know what the sound is, but there's like this pipe sound when Shao comes in that just like blew my mind. And that's what,
it kinda, that's switch my up. Favorite Shao verse on that album.
Dude.
That whole song is hammer. That song is nice. Yeah. Isn't that Street Fighter?
Yes,
no, Bolo Young?
No, it's Street Fighter. Yeah, yeah.
Street Fighter, that's right. Yeah.
Because it does like the Mortal Kombat, like, whoop, and then.
Yeah.
Because I actually saw that. I experienced that one for the first time live, actually. I saw them at Numos. And that's where I heard that the first time. I was like, what the fuck just happened? Because, like, the way it just blasted through the speakers, like, blew my mind. So, but I know the songs are obviously very different, but I remember that switch up and being like, oh, like, this is super dope. Y'all have done a fantastic job on all the releases that have come out, because that's always something I'm always like on my toes, you know, in like the best way.
Yeah, I mean, asymmetrical arrangement is, it drives people nuts. I'll be like, bring back the chorus. Yeah. Like, for what?
Yeah.
They don't want to listen to the song for 4 minutes, bro. They don't want to do it. Go look at one of the most successful beat tapes of all time. The average track length, I think, is a minute 38. It's Donuts. Like,
oh, really?
You know, yeah, by Dilla. Like, come on. It's a bunch of little fragments, but it makes you run it back. That's what you want. You don't want somebody pressing fast forward. That's death.
That's true.
That's how we keep them interested. That's how they did it back in the day. On the East Coast, like, the New York mixtape scene was really crazy in the, like, 2006, 2007 when I was going to Berkeley. And one thing they did that really just pissed me off so much, but now I'm like, oh, yeah, it's so smart. They would take, like, just a verse from a song, and that would be on their, like, summer sampler, right?
Oh, no, that would kill me.
You've run that verse back, like, 20 times, being like, why? Why is there half of a B.O.B. verse on here? What? Like, yeah. But, hey, they got you. They got you keep interested. And there's something to be said for that. That run it back, like, thing, that's pretty powerful. That's what I always aim for. I want people, even if it's just because they're confused. Like, hold on here. I need to slow down. This guy lost me. 4 bars ago.
Oh, that's too funny. How is you guys' working relationship evolved since you came to House of Breaking Glass? Because I've even just seen on social media, you've been like, hey, we're going to be working on some stuff here. Or what I say, House of Breaking Glass. Yeah, how is that, like, helping evolve, like, what you guys are doing?
Well, I think this place definitely represents kind of the next step in our sound, for sure. Just me as a producer and an artist and a writer, Nobi as an artist and producer and writer himself. We've done plenty of work up here. So we're very familiar with the space. We've been working with Philip for the last 6-7 months already before I moved up here, which makes it extra nice. Like,
yeah,
I already knew
comfortable.
I already knew what it was going to be like.
Yeah.
You know, if you had told me during the Entity show that I was going to be up here one day, I'd have cried back then. I'd have been like, no way, that's possible. Yeah, but so, and I think that's what made it an easier transition, is because we started incorporating live instruments more. And I took a lot of things that I was getting really good at through Fulminate and Catalyst, which was synths and synthesis, sampling, a lot of the more digital side of things, and started applying more of the real life recording, like drums, cellos, timpanis, you know, like just starting to explore different techniques and ways of creating the sound and adding to the sound and making it more extreme or dramatic or invoking more feelings out of it. So definitely it's cool, because we've just, like, kind of grown through these spaces over the last 5 years, 5-6 years. And yeah.
Yeah, it's super cool that you've literally got physical like location shifts to mark like the level ups, you know? Yep. What I mean, I moved around a lot growing up, so I've always appreciate, like, I almost like crave sometimes a switch up in scenery. I'm like, when I feel like life's changing, I really dig that. So I think that's super cool that you guys are getting that. And we talked about it a little bit beforehand, but y'all are like, the studio itself and is doing a lot of really cutting edge innovative stuff. So you as a producer, obviously we're in like tough times with this like COVID, you know, 19 stuff that's going around. Like, how are you personally like navigating that, and what have you found successful just kind of like keep your head on straight and keep working?
I think understanding, like, I kind of had this feeling that most live shows are out the window right away. And I think the other feeling that I had right away was like, it's not a bad, it's bad because I love live shows and I love being live, but I think that's, there's like this exciting prospect about this new frontier that we're all of a sudden on, which is, how do we connect with the fans?
Yeah.
How do we get that touch and that interaction back? And I think that's one of the things we're starting to work with here is live streaming and live concerts, even without audiences. Because, you know, we're an essential business because of that, our essential service because of that. And I mean, it's crazy. This is such a level playing field.
Yeah.
And I say that because we're in week three of this, and within the first week we were getting write-ups in the Seattle Times for some of the live stream shows that we're doing and hosting out of here. So there's people that instantly see the value in connecting with audiences in this way, and it's cool. And one of the things that we're really trying to push the envelope on is like adapting to the fact that visual is becoming a medium that we have to be familiar with now.
Yeah, very much so.
And as somebody who co-produced most of the music videos that we released last year, it's kind of funny because I've already involuntarily been flung into this,
right?
You know, like
I kind of know what's going on here.
Yeah, designing sets and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, weird. But I'm also like, I feel like most artists that I know kind of low key train themselves to be on this level. But I also feel like it's similar to the path of a cook, where you like spend all this time aching and dying trying to learn how to cook this one dish. And then you finally get it right, and the chef comes by and he's like, good job. Now make 100 of them.
Yeah. You're like, you're like, oh,
what? You know, like. So I think that's the moment where we might be at, because it really is like that. It's like one of the other things I recognize is you think you make enough content, but maybe it's like 30 pieces to 60 pieces a week now. And maybe it's like, if you're not on live like X amount of hours a day, like it's a job, right?
Yeah.
You know, like... Some people are sitting back and collecting the unemployment checks. Other people are trying to figure out where the openings are.
Artists across the board are like going to have to adapt to this new environment. Even
Dude, my band was supposed to be on tour literally starting on Friday.
Oh, I hate to see it.
We were trying to, I was trying to get ahead of it, you know, a couple weeks back, and talking with these venues of like, hey, can we target August? And now some of them are like, until there's a vaccine, we probably won't be, you know, booking heavily, especially out of town acts. And we might be looking at like 2021. And I was like, oh.
No, and it might be even longer than that.
Yeah, it's gonna be intense, man.
That's insane. we were talking about that today at the studio, you know, because we're all players. We all like playing live. So that's a crazy hit. It's like, think back to your last big show, and that's the last time you can play live
until 2021, probably, for a bigger crowd than 50. It's just not happening.
Sure hopes. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a wild time. And it was really cool talking to Marshall about, you know, the kind of stuff that he's working on right now to try and make sure that there is that support when all this blows over.
Yeah, I think that's – and it's a juxtaposition. It's like, what can you capitalize on at the same time, you know? And Marshall's and Tane and them, they're doing a pretty good job of doing live streams and trying to get people involved in that capacity.
Couldn't agree more. They're doing some awesome stuff. And one thing that I think is really important is for us that can't be going out and doing shows to just learn some new skills. And rant warning, and not to go too far off the rails, a buddy of mine introduced me to one of his friends. She's majoring in songwriting at Central, and she didn't know songwriting could be a career path or what sync licensing was. And I was like, wait a sec, you're paying for an education and your professor hasn't equipped you with the knowledge of like how you could have a career in songwriting?
Well, and then you got to look at the college institutions that are teaching that way. It's like you're selling snake oil at that point in time.
Yeah.
When the affliction is like, you know, something that's easily curable just by the right knowledge.
Totally. Yeah, it blew my mind.
I mean, and that now more than ever, publishing and sync licensing is becoming the new hot topic. It's going to continue to grow. I think it's going to go, we're going to see expansion of in-home entertainment and live and kind of interaction. I think a lot of brands and streaming services are going to start utilizing songwriters and content that's made more tactile quicker. You know, it's going to be in some cases more accessible for the songwriter to get into the publishing market.
Totally. I could totally see even like indie publishing house or indie artists or collectives putting together some sort of thing like a marketing agency almost.
Yeah.
Where I work on the day to day. And I literally this morning I had a guy that was like, hey, by Friday, can you get me something like this? I could totally see that turning into like a music agency almost of, hey, we don't like the stock stuff that we're getting from, you know, Audio Jungle. We want someone who's on that can curate content.
Hey. We need to talk then for sure, because like that's right up my alley. I mean, that's kind of what we're doing over here, definitely. But I see a lot of kind of production collectives starting to think similarly on these levels for sure, because there's definitely like groups of people that are just making huge catalogs right now.
It's going to be crazy. I think to your point, it's all going to change so much. And I'm interested to see what happens to like the recording artist. You know what I mean? Like, obviously we've got like pop stars and there's like brand that goes way bigger when all the money for the past 10 years, for the most part, has been live music. I'm interested to see how these labels react. I mean, obviously they've gotten themselves positioned pretty nicely with streaming and whatnot, but you know, all these huge pop stars that just put out records and their whole plan was a stadium tour. And obviously that's what the label's banking on. I'm like, well, I'm really curious as to how all of this is going to position the massive artists. Obviously they're going to be okay, I think, but
wow. But that live money is crazy, man.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Is it's like, it probably makes more sense to pay a bunch of smaller songwriters and producers to crank out the content than it is to go get your Ricky Reed or something like that. You know what I mean? So
wow.
Like the sync kind of stuff. So,
oh, absolutely. Well, it's going to be interesting. It's almost like, are they going to take like a hibernation approach with it, where they just put these artists that would normally be going on tour into songwriting circuits where they're pumping out jingles? Because I feel like that's happened before in the industry, right? We started seeing like pop artists do all these jingles for like Pepsi and Coke and stuff like that.
Right. You got the Carrie Underwoods Monday night or Sunday night football or whatever.
Offset bad to do a Mountain Dew commercial.
He knew. No, just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Sell it.
But it's gonna be crazy. I think you're totally right. There's some of those stars that can absolutely go into hibernation. Like, great. The second this is all cleared, the tour is gonna be bigger than ever because everyone wants to get out there.
I'm curious who's gonna do like the first 3D AR concert or VR concert.
Yeah.
Which one of the big stars is going to be jumping on that first? That's going to happen by the time this year's over, I bet.
I think you're 100% right. And I think that's super important for anybody that wants to actually do this for a living. Is to your point, this is a great opportunity to innovate and find out what's going on. And like what your identity is going to be, because even if it's new, there's so much out there that you can craft yourself and work on yourself and put that out there. But like, now's the time to refine. Like, we can't wait till this, I mean, hopefully it doesn't become the normal, but for a while we're going to be in this situation. And to your point,
until a vaccine hits the market. And even if it's not, like, the bottom line is, like, look at a perfect example. Look at how much of a difference 3 weeks makes for Tory Lanez.
Dude, he...
he's, like, the most popular man in hip-hop, period.
Yeah.
There's nobody, except for Drake.
Yeah.
Toronto's winning. Wow.
Yeah, for real, though.
Right?
It was crazy. I saw him like retweet the guy that put up the metrics that he'd done in like, I think it went up last week, but it was of like his month leading up to the release. And it was insane. It was all just him being authentic and telling his story and like that war with the record label. And he was like, I'm telling, how is the day that I get out of this contract? Like we're all in this together. And people just like rallied to him. And it was like 2.2. I mean, not that social media is the best indicator, but people flocked him. It was like 2.2 million people in 4 weeks. Like, holy crap.
That in his IG live stuff is insane. Yeah. I mean, you got 100,000 people tuning in.
Yeah.
Man.
Unreal.
There ain't no radio station that's getting that.
Yeah, no way. And to your point, it's how you take advantage of the times where you
that's all he did.
Put your
the
nose
dude's on it. The dude's on a studio microphone. I'm sure when people looked it up at first, they're like, what is this idiot doing with that microphone like that? He's looking pretty smart right now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Everybody holding up their Neumann U87s like idiots. And I'm like, God. Spitting all of that. $3,000 mic. I hate to see it. Yeah, but that's the point. That's the point. That guy got whatever he wants. He has the attention of hundreds of thousands of people right now because he paid attention. He did not miss the set in like a second.
No, it's really
that's the crazy part.
And it's cool to see because it also proves to people, like, you know, I think sometimes we get caught up in the, oh, it's not attainable kind of thing because you need to have certain resources. But to your point, he was on Instagram Live and telling his story.
It's in the consistency. It's in the, and so, and yeah, so I think that's kind of like, even when it goes back to normal, I'd be surprised if we see, if we don't see some sort of major innovation in entertainment in the next year or two.
Oh, I 100% agree
with you. I think this is just closing the doors for a lot of big labels, a lot of big systems and old machines. I think it's making way for more tactile operations to come up and make a presence, because local reach, guess what? It's all we got right now.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. In the internet.
Yeah,
that's all you got. Like,
and there's really something to be said for that approach too, of like cultivating your community. Even if you go back to like the grass, like the way Nirvana did it back in the day, it was the they didn't do the move to LA. And I'm not saying this is the roadmap, right, or the blueprint, but it is interesting. Like you mentioned, you've got your local community and internet, and it's like, okay, you double down with who you've got, and if you deliver to them, they're gonna help you grow this thing. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. I mean, to your point, you guys started doing those live stream concerts and Seattle Times is picking it up, you know?
It's incredible to like see a response that quickly too. It's like we did a live stream the next day. And that's really cool because I think like, and also like kudos to Seattle and LA Times just in general on that stuff. Cause for them to jump on it right away and be like, there's value in this is really, really actually pretty supportive thing. That's the kind of support the art scene definitely needs, but it's already been starting to see because of Marshall and no doubt.
Cool, man. Well, look, I know I've taken a lot more of your time than initially intended. So I truly appreciate you, doing this. I guess, do you want to give some shouts out to what you got going on? I know you've got a lot in the pipeline. So A, how can people stay up to date with you and what should we be looking for?
Yeah, man. You can follow me on Instagram at instagram.com/DGTL beats or and then anything dropping from Nobi basically is music I'd be plugging at this moment, but
right, yeah.
We do have something coming up probably in the next month, it's looking like that we're really excited to share. It's definitely more relevant now than it ever has been. And you can go check out Nobi on Instagram, AO Blasian, on Twitter, AO Blasian, or at NobiSays.com, where you can find all of our releases from 2019 and our most recent release, which is the Entity Tiny Desk Audition. So, yeah.
Sweet, man. Well, hey, cheers to you. Stay healthy, man. Again, I really appreciate you taking this time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I'm excited to see what's up next for y'all. Be sure to plug it. Anytime you got some, just let me know. Let me know. I can help out, help push it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be sending you some.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm looking forward to it. Cheers, man.
All right, later. Have a good night.
You as well. Was Soul on Wax by The Digital. That song just got finished up and is not on all major platforms yet, so shouts out to him for giving us all a sneak peek and just for putting on for the guys that he's working with. So be sure to support him, follow him on social media. His Instagram handle is Digital Beats, DGTL Beats. He's got a lot of great stuff coming up with Nobi, who's AO Blasian, AYOBLASIAN. Stay tuned, and as always, if you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Truly appreciate that extra effort. Stay safe out there, and I will see you next time.